Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Today, I'm very pleased, very honored, very happy to have as my guest creative catalyst, producer, director, and so much more, Jamie Cotto. Jamie, how are you?
I'm great. What a pleasure to be in your presence.
Yes, it's great.
And to a goose pond in England.
Yeah. And happy Father's Day, by the way.
Thank you. Today is the first Father's Day of my life that's ever been observed.
Oh, well.
The first time when they went for it and cards and making a big deal out of it. And I must say, another day in which to celebrate another aspect of my being.
There you go.
Universe.
There you go. Jamie Cotto is one of the masterminds behind the double Grammy-nominated Global Philosophy and Music Project One Giant Leap and its follow-up What About Me, which won the Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary at Red Rock Film Festival. Jamie is also a founding member, singer, art director, and video director of the dance music supergroup Faithless. He's also been a producer, composer for the globally renowned artists such as Dido and Emiliana Torini, drawing from the richly diverse wisdom techniques and processes he's encountered during his groundbreaking filming, recording, and philosophical voyages across five continents. Jamie has amassed a body of creative techniques and exercises which he uses in his current professional and personal breakthrough workshops. Quite a list of accomplishments, Jamie. Well done.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Thanks.
To bring us up to speed with what's happening with you currently, I thought it might make a little bit of sense, especially for those folks listening that might not be so familiar with your work, to go back to some of your earlier accomplishments and then make our way back to the present. Why don't you start out by telling us a little about Faithless, and then perhaps lead into how you met Duncan Bridgman and going on to create One Giant Leap.
Yeah, Faithless was the first time when I remember I had been in a band and had to put it on ice when my girlfriend at the time was pregnant with my now eldest kid, Indy. And I remember I had to put the music on ice and get a job teaching English, and I was cool with it, but I was just feeling more and more like, come on, destiny, I want to step up, I want to step into the creative field and be fully supported. And I remember having a really impassioned speech to my girlfriend at the time, driving home, about how I was ready, not just for a good gig, but for something that lifted the whole game to dive right in. And I really felt like, you know, the moment in Big with Tom Hanks when he says what he really wants and you hear the wind blows through the glass and the curtain billows and the tinkle noises. Anyway, as I got home, the phone was ringing, and I opened the front door to a record deal, basically, in the long and short of it, which was being invited to come and write with Rollo for this side project called Faithless. And then that actually became a band, and the four of us suddenly were having like photo shoots and flashing lights and a lot of success in Europe, where it sold millions and millions and millions of records. And yeah, soon after doing the videos and the art direction for all that, I got a very huge... again, the subtlest things happen and life goes left. I was living in Brighton in the south of England, and my lodger, who was a great didgeridoo playing nutritionalist called Jem, asked me if a friend of his could use his bedroom while he was away that weekend. I said, yeah, sure. I totally forgot about it. And late that Friday night, there's a knock at the door, and this guy Duncan with his girlfriend Faith turn up, and I'd totally forgotten why, and they explained it to me, and we sat in the kitchen drinking tea. and realized we had just so many of the same sort of random opinions about music, which we've totally shared, our love of the players and the singers of world music, and yet our disappointment at the world music albums that were available. Like, wow, these guys play so incredibly, they sing so incredibly, why are none of the CDs incredible? What's the problem here? And so that was when we had this idea, you know what, someone should really do some music where they showcase how incredible all these singers and players are and make it unmissable even to the Western ear. And that was the birth of One Giant Leap, really, that passion to make everything that's incredible about Baba Mal or the African drummers or the flute players of India or wherever we were recording, how to make it unmissable, how brilliant they are, deliver the brilliantness into the hearts and ears of anyone we could.
Yeah. Well done. You know, when I first saw One Giant Leap, it completely blew my mind to that point. I'd never really seen a film quite like it. You know, how you'd manage to document people all around the world being interviewed, performing poetry, collaborating on similar pieces of music, and how you wove it all together into this sonic visual patchwork quilt. How did you come up with the idea to create a film that looked and sounded that particular way?
Well, there were a couple of things. The first was we wanted to make, because we're musicians, we know that when I make an album, if I really make it brilliantly, you'll listen to it from your whole life. You know, your favorite albums will live with you forever. But your favorite films, you won't see that many times. Even your favorite films, you're not going to, they usually go on the shelf. So we wanted to make a film that really was repeated viewings in the same way as an album is repeated listening. As you live with it forever, you hear different things, different parts of it become relevant or favorite at different parts of your life. And so that's the first thing, was that the film was supposed to be a new kind of thing whereby it was so rich and it was so layered and it was so full of everything that was touching and inspirational to us that you could never eat it all in one gulp. And the second thing was that because I've been doing the videos for Faithless, the company that were giving us the money for the album said, hey, we're actually a film company. It was great, actually. The people that gave us the money for the first One Giant Leap was this maverick, genius, wonderful, inspirational man called Chris Blackwell, who was also the guy that signed Bob Marley and U2 and started Island Records years ago.
Yeah.
He's an icon. So there was something that felt very auspicious about being backed by him for this kind of mission around the world. And we knew if we were going to make a film for him that it wasn't going to be that interesting just going and making lots of different music sessions with different people and plugging in instruments. That's not a great film. We went away to have dinner and thought about it and thought, wow, God, the possibilities here. We could include everything we've ever loved, everything that's anyone that's turned us on, any writer that we think is incredible, we could talk to them, any, you know, incredible teacher or spiritual person or freaky, marginalized person living on the fringes of life with a passionate opinion, or gay kids, prostitutes, criminals. We could ask everyone about the big themes of life. And we didn't know it at the time, but what we were actually on was a mission towards finding the unity in all that diversity, but we didn't know it yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it really comes across in the final film, so that's interesting that you weren't aware of it at the time, but what you ended up with definitely succeeded in achieving that goal. You know, you had something, I believe, like 50 locations on 5 continents, all filmed in 7 months, you know, and I'm not even sure what it was like on What About Me. How did you decide where you're going to go and who was going to be in the film? Well, for that matter, both films.
The two main things were that where we wanted to go was purely decided, particularly at the beginning, by music we wanted to record, things that we had used as samples or used as, you know, demos to hear, to create the sound we wanted. Let's say a certain, you know, Ghanaian drummers, the troops of drummers in Ghana, you know, incredible. Some of the drums are big as a person, like the Royal drums. They play with sticks, which are sort of at right angles anyway. So we go to that place, you know, and we'd also heard in Uganda that they had a kind of huge xylophone that they built into the earth, or a drum, and we wanted to go and seek that out. Or we knew that we wanted to work with Hari Prasad Chaurasia, the incredible old Indian flute player. It was all music-led. or somebody who we loved, like Kurt Vonnegut in New York, or Tom Robbins in Seattle. You know, it was where they were. We went to go and harvest, you know, to fish for them.
Yeah. You know, some of the places you ended up in both the first and second film were pretty extreme locations where you witnessed poverty, disease, you know, and customs that were far different than yours. I'm curious, what did those people make of you coming into their lives, and what were some of the lessons you learned about your own life from those experiences?
The deepest one that I'd like to share, since you asked, is, and it just shows itself to be true more and more, is that no matter where you go or how diverse it's like, I used to think my life was about finding the truth, finding the model, which was the true model, and then going about and sharing that model with everyone and trying to get everyone to see that model of, you know, how life should be. But the more you travel, the more you realize the whole point of this planet is there's a million or more, you know, there's as many different models on how life should be as there are souls walking around the planet. There's 7 billion versions of exactly how life should be.
Yeah.
And there were many, many times where we would be outraged by something or knocked sideways by something. You know, in some places, people would be just so, so welcoming into the culture. In other places, with certain Maori people, you go away with a Maori tattoo on your shoulder, they want to, you know, they're like, how dare you take some of our ancestral magic off with you? Who do you think you are? You know, you can walk, turn left into something you thought was beautiful and suddenly find yourself in a situation. And there was something about the root of it being in such a sort of open-handed, foolish way that we were walking around, not trying to be cool, not trying to be politically correct, not trying to be anything other than people fascinated by everything, that somehow seemed to protect us as we went on our merry way.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about, let's talk a little about What About Me. I mean, you know, when I had heard that you were doing a follow-up to One Giant Leap, I was extremely excited. You know, I mean, you know, What About Me, it features such great, you know, as Katie Lang, Krishna Das, Ram Das, Noam Chomsky, Michael Franti, Michael Stipe, the list goes on and on. And I know that one was a little bit of a challenge for you, especially trying to, you know, get distribution in the States and things like that. I was wondering if you could talk a little about your experience with that film and how it related to the first.
Well, the first one was about just anything to do with the unity of a human experience. So the chapters were like God, sex, death, money, universal themes where no matter where you were, you could talk about them. And it was just, you know, to find out the thread between it all. But the second one, we'd realized that there was no greater unity to be found than in our collective insanity, in all the ways we avoid pain, in all the ways we deny how full of desire we are, in all the ways that we are sort of bombarded by our minds, bombarded by the pace of modern life, the shadow, all the things we suppress, all the ways that we make ourselves appropriate and prostitute ourselves. Suddenly, the universality of the human condition, that became something that became really exciting to talk about, that because when we talked about it, the oxygen came into the room. And the more we talked about those kinds of subjects, when people came to see the film, they kind of felt a feeling of a permission slip to be slightly more themselves, and in the Q&As afterwards, slightly talking about things that were a bit more, not just like a usual director's Q&A after a screening, people suddenly getting with the idea of us exhausting ourselves every day trying to maintain a normal, fitting in, sane mask for everybody. And my work since then has always been directly about oxygenating that human disease of appropriateness and hiding who we really are, and not having the support or the courage to be really visible and love ourselves, not let other people love us for all of ourselves, because we would never let it get seen. It's ourselves. We abandon our own dark places. because I don't show it to you, so I don't give you the chance to love me in it.
Right.
I'm the one who makes sure that dark place never gets love, not you. It's we are abandoning ourselves in our dark places. No one externally is abandoning us. And in fact, these sort of shaky, edgy parts of ourselves we never show or rarely show each other, those are the eccentricities and the unique shapes that we actually fall in love with in each other. And that's where the intimacy lies, in being with those places. There's nothing exciting or romantic or lyrical about being with someone's appropriate side.
Do you think that that was... some of those ideas were perhaps a little more uncomfortable with some people to deal with in relation to the first film, or what are your thoughts about that?
No, I think they were the opposite. I think it was like such a fresh air, and that was the experience of showing it and sending it. It was the only place it got released so far because of funny ownership-y other things. The only place it got fully released before there was a freeze was Australia, and it went gold in 3 weeks. You know, everyone could
make nice
of it. And now, this week, actually, now it's finally sort of come out of prison and is now going to be released in America and across the world. So everybody.
Oh, well done, well done. You know, I helped to arrange some screenings here in Los Angeles a while back, and. You know, Duncan was there for one of the Q&As, and, you know, pretty much one of the main questions that came out when, you know, I helped to arrange some of those screenings, you know, why isn't this, you know, why can't more people see this? Why isn't this film everywhere? You know, there are such pertinent messages in this film. Everyone needs to see this. So I'm glad that it's more people will be able to see it.
Me too. You have to be patient. You know, it was such an epic experience making that thing. And as you know, on a personal level, areas of my personal life that were also in total meltdown and transformation throughout
yeah.
post-production. So, you know, it was such an epic shift and experience, the 5 years or 3.5 years, really, that was the turnaround of that production, that... you have to really, really let go after that and not have the attachment to outcome of where it goes or what happens to it or anything. You know, you just have to sort of, when you finish things in a way, totally wash your hands of all of what you were doing that was about the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Can get in the way. And it's been
a beautiful way of putting it.
Because it's you know, when we were younger and we were making music, or when we were younger and we were first writing our little poems, you know, my whole childhood was made of writing poems and four-line stanzas that rhymed every fourth, you know, like they don't, you know, scanning like a donkey. when we did that, we were doing it, we weren't doing it for any outcome, not even parental approval especially. I don't remember being so quick to show them to everybody. I was just really getting off on the form and the exploration of words rhyming and tumbling over each other and telling little stories. We were just into it. And I remember when I first got the guitar and started learning the first 3 chords, the first 5 chords, I just couldn't stop writing songs. The guitar went everywhere with us. We weren't doing it for any outcome. We were doing it because we were just so into it. That was what we wanted to do after breakfast. And that's the core of what I really want to reclaim for myself and others in my life right now, is the use of my waking hours doing what really, really turns me on. Because I have a feeling that me being really excited and turned on, and everyone being really excited and turned on by their day, is going to generate the kind of energy which is going to create whatever healing, eco, sustainability, all the things everybody wants. It's going to be rooted in everyone doing what they want after breakfast and being really turned on and excited to meet their day. That is going to be the core of it.
Right. Well, speaking of you playing music, I would love to play a track of yours right now. I believe it's called My World, correct?
A rocking out song.
We're gonna rock out with Jamie Cotto right now, My World, on Poetescape.
drift away again. I've been controlling every moment I could hold you. I keep me guessing, but my mind said it would serve me well. And all it asked for was my body and my soul. I lie awake so I can run it all around my head. That's how I'm playing every move. But my world don't hold me like you do. Is that the truth? My world don't hold me like you do. Ah, yeah. Oh, won't you shake me? Talking in my sleep, I keep on going while my body takes a rest. Oh yeah, so much to think about. I know it's nothing I can keep. I write it down so I remember what it says. And even if I get a hold on everything I see, don't mean a thing without you. My world.
And that was Jamie Cotto with My World. You know, Jamie, I think I saw you once do an acoustic version of that song. So it was it's interesting to hear a full production of it. You know, after What About Me, and maybe you were doing this before What About Me, but I became aware of it afterwards. You began creating and facilitating various workshops exploring topics such as creativity, emotions, trauma. I'm curious, what pointed you in that direction, and can you talk a bit more specifically about some of your work in that area?
I wanted to get more directly into what do I have to give. And I thought to myself, you know, if I got a whole bunch of people together, what would I actually have to give them? What would be my offering? And I realized that a big part of one thing I have worked out without being trained, a sort of self-worked out, self-trained and made up systems to make an idea that I've had go out of my head actually into the world. I've done a lot of different projects that have ended up sort of happening by maverick avenues. And so I realized I really know a lot about facilitating getting an idea out of oneself into the world, and also doing it from a place where you are so touched and so raw and so vulnerable and so brave in throwing yourself and devoting yourself fully to the process that the audience at the end of it are so touched and are taken somewhere very, very personal as well. That's really what I want to make in all of my work. I want to be so illuminated in it that the people in the audience have see themselves in it, so that the work becomes like a mirror, if it can possibly be. The best films, the best music, they take us into a part of ourselves when you go, oh, hello, and you remember a part of yourself.
Yeah. You know, from your workshop experience, or for that matter, your life experience, what have you seen to be some of the things that wound us in this life, and also what are some of the things that you see healing people?
The thing that wounds us is that it might, you know, one way you could put it is that, you know, maybe there is this big oneness everywhere, the oneness, God, the universe, the unity. Certainly to come to planet Earth, you have to take a forgetting pill that makes you think you're an individual just for this birth to death thing, in order to function on planet Earth, to experience duality, to hot and cold, soft and hard, you and me. There needs to be you and me. There needs to be two things. We have to be away from, and therefore I have to think I'm an individual in order to have this experience of being on planet Earth as a human. That's the core wound. And all suffering, it's the admission fee for coming on the theme park of planet Earth, but it's also the core wound. It's only just worth the admission fee. And for long periods of my life, not worth it. All alienation, isolation, heartbreak, rejection, it all comes from the lie that we need to tell ourselves that we're separate from everything else in order to function in this theme park. And any time we experience the opposite of that, when we merge with our lover, or we're playing incredibly laughing, you know, with our kids, or we're at a concert and our band play the opening chords of our favorite song and we all roar together in appreciation, or at a sporting event when our team scores, we all roar and we experience it on TV all around the country together. It's those moments that pay the big bucks, that everyone is hungering towards, is to keep that feeling of merging with another, merging with the group, being more than just the individuated, isolated I, and feeling connection. So anything which is to do with connection, which is to do with being visible, not hiding, is healing. And anything to do with, you know, hiding and isolating, not into solitude, but the alienation and loneliness that has come for a lot of people in the way that we've set up life, and the way we have to be cool, or the way we have to be appropriate in our circle or at work or with our family, has made people feel so lonely inside themselves, because they can't share who they really are with anyone, because it won't get approval, or it won't get loved, or it might get rejected, or it might shock people, or dishearten them, or disappoint them, or God help us. So the amount of hiding that goes on for your average city dweller or person on Earth is so chronic hiding. That's the exact opposite. That's what's hurting. So anything that stops that hiding, anything which makes us really see each other, be with each other, and oxygenate that stuff is what I'm wanting in my life and what I want to manifest for others.
Yeah. Yeah, and speaking of healing and oxygenating, you are finishing up a film about Ram Dass, I believe. I was hoping you could talk a little about that.
Yeah, I'm just starting it, really. I have a long way to go, but it's he's been the first and foremost, most exciting and hilarious and edgy narrator and orator about these subjects of existence and the masks that we wear and what's really going on. I just love him. He wrote the book Be Here Now in the 60s. And who better to do a film about celebrating everything that we condemn, deny, and reject is, I think, the Juice. And so to do a film with him, using both his archive but also an interview with both of us talking from recently, have a conversation and a really good, maybe One Giant Leap style pathway through the musical and visual representation of all those concepts about how really all the things we reject are the things which are trying to heal us or make us whole or illuminate us.
Right.
We've got our heads on backwards. That's what I believe, and sort of the root of the workshops is that we so much we're looking at life as what it's doing to us, what we have to survive, what we have to control our way out of, what we're a victim to. And we look at it as if it is not benevolent, and therefore it has become something we need to survive. But there's another way to look at it, and you don't need to try this for longer than 3 weeks for it to prove itself to definitely work. If you just imagine for 3 weeks that the whole of life is set up to be benevolent and to help you, and that things that come, even if they're challenging, they're either there to illuminate you or to trigger you into discharging a lot of trauma, like your body reacts, you get a chance to breathe into it. I believe that all adversity is there to either illuminate me or to trigger my front channel to start churning up so that I can breathe into it and discharge some constipated shit, basically.
Yeah.
That's the point of adversity in my life. It's either illuminating me or it's triggering me so that I can breathe into some stuff down my front channel and dissolve it. And therefore, I'm constantly being given rocket fuel, not being given hindrances.
You know, besides Ram Dass, who do you feel are some of the shaker-uppers that are helping to wake up the world, and what is it that they're doing to help achieve this goal?
Let me see. Louis C.K., the comedian, is the first one that comes to mind. Because he's just broadening the taboo around the darkness. Every human has dark appetites, self-disgust, a kind of rebellion, pointless rebellion as well as a healthy one. You know, he really makes us laugh at the corners of ourselves that no one wants to be seen in public, so he makes himself a spectacle of the worst you could think of. It is very, very, you laugh while you're laughing, you suddenly are kind of feeling like the feeling of blood coming back into a muscle. It's just a certain wholeness in our darkness. We are everything. There's a great book also, I think this woman died actually recently, I think she's called Debbie Ford. There's a book, The Dark Side of the Light Chasers.
Great title.
And that very much expressed it beautifully as well, which is that we are whole and everything that we are saying we're not will bang down the door to get to us.
Wow, that's beautiful. You know, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I definitely want to talk about one or two things before we part ways. I was hoping you could talk a little about WIMP.
Oh, great. Raisa Breslava, my partner and partner in crime, is directing WIMP, which is a one-man show starting in London this September. And she has decided that she loves men, but not just the nice, cool, good-looking, appropriate sides of men. She loves all the yucky, vulnerable, shaky, unusual, eccentric sides of men. And so she took a one man and went deep into him as the text and just unearthed every part of him she could and all the different characters that make one man, what really makes a man. And that's the show. I'm going to compose some music for it. You are going to have a part in it as well as some of your stanzas from your poem about man.
Yeah.
And there's an Indiegogo site. I don't know what the URL is.
That was something I was hoping you could, talk about. People out there listening, they've got an Indiegogo site for WIMP. If you can, help Jamie and Raisa gather the funds together to mount the production.
We bring it to LA.
Oh, nice. Now,
it should go on the road. It's really an amazing show. This guy is a mixture between a really great actor who dives deep into all these very, very visceral characters of himself, some very taboo in a way, But also he dances beautifully. A lot of it is physical theatre, and the way he moves, he's strong, you know, and a graceful body to watch in motion. I'm enjoying him.
Yeah, it has a very Bhutto quality to it. There's a Bhutto dancer here in L.A., a guy named Oguri, and when I saw your guy for Wimp, some of his movements very much reminded me of Oguri and Bhutto, and how he could sort of fluidly and sort of just go between all these different emotions with just from one to the other seamlessly. It was really quite beautiful. You know that space, because you guys created the video to help promote the production, there's that beautiful space, almost like an abandoned church, or I don't know what it is exactly,
yeah, it is.
But
it's
that where... Is that where you're going to be doing the show?
Yeah, that is the stage, what you were looking at in the trailer.
Oh, my God, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. There are a lot of places, like empty places like that in London. Can you find me a place as old as that in L.A.? It's about 350 years old.
We have no sense of history here in L.A., you know. We go back to about the 1920s with the advent of film, and before that, I don't know. But I will be on the lookout. So, getting to our closing moments, Jamie, what would you say is the Jamie Cotto manifesto?
Ever-changing, but I would say the manifesto is to really, really love ourselves, not to depend on other people, not to abandon us, but to show the bits that we're abandoning so that everyone can love us fully, bring to light all of ourselves so that it can all be loved by whoever, because all these unlovable, perceived unlovable parts of ourselves are the seat of the limitations in our careers and projects, the seat of the limitations in our relationships, the seat of our illness. It's all in the ways we're not letting all of ourselves come out into the sunshine to be loved and seen. So that bravery of step by little step coming out into being seen more and more and more, is the act of self-love that seems, what do you mean love yourself? What do you mean love yourself? And, you know, it's all about you can't love others till you love yourself. What does it mean? What does it mean? I'll tell you what it means. It means letting more and more of yourself, a little bit like a bit, let yourself be seen by others close to you. More and more, let yourself be seen. That is what self-love is.
Nice. Beautiful. So, Jamie, where can people find you online?
Oh, jamiecatto.com, C-A-T-T-O. I'm going to do one of my workshops online in like September or October. I'm going to do the What About You Creative Masterclass, but I'm going to let anyone that puts a room together anywhere in the world, like in America, you've got a room full of your friends that want to do the workshop. We will wire up live the workshop from London straight into all these different rooms around the world, and everyone will participate in the green lighting of like 1,000 projects all at once on a weekend.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I'm gonna have to talk to you more about that after the show. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's been a true honor.
I just love hanging out with you, Rich. It's so great. Last time I saw you was, I think, in Los Angeles. I can't wait to hang out with you again. Did I hear a rumor that you got engaged today?
Yeah, this past week. Yes, I did.
Oh, my God. Everybody listening, got engaged. The man is getting engaged. The man's in love. He's in love. Let's just celebrate his love. The dying moment of this show. Let's just celebrate Rich's love.
Woohoo! Well, thank you, Jamie. And, oh, man, yeah, what an honor. And, you know, I just love you and Duncan and everything you do, and all my best to you and to everything you do and to Ryza with Wimp. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can also find them online at rarebirdlit.com. The show's theme music is by We Voice Sing. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook. Next week, my guest will be poet, educator, Kelly Allen. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.